one and all.
Good morning.
I'm going to call to order this meeting of the Committee on Higher Education. And here's the order of agenda today. Representative Dembro is testifying elsewhere. He will be in a little bit. Until then, I'm going to, with Victoria's able assistance, try to run things here. We will, first of all, have public hearings on House Bills 2995, 3245, and 3472, followed by a public hearing, possible work session on House Bill 2838, work session on House Bill 3025. So let's begin by opening a public hearing on House Bill 2995. And Rep. Gelser, would you like to kick us off after a little intro by Victoria?
Thank you. Members of the committee, House Bill 2995 requires each public university, community college, or other institution of higher education to allow students, faculty, and staff to identify sexual orientation on forms used to collect demographic data. Chair Harker, members of the committee, good morning. Thank you. For the record, my name is Sarah Gelser, state representative from House District 16, which includes Corvallis and Philomath. I wanted to thank you for scheduling a public hearing on House Bill 2995, and I also wanted to thank my constituent, Stephen Leiter, for contacting me with a request for this bill. Stephen is a passionate advocate at Oregon State University for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgendered students. Last year, he sent me a copy of a new California law that allowed students and staff the option to identify their sexual orientation on forms used to collect other demographic information, such as gender, race, disability, or ethnicity. House Bill 2995 would do the same for Oregon College and University students, faculty, and staff. The reason this bill is important is that it recognizes that just like other underrepresented and minority groups, like women, racial minorities, and people with disabilities, gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgendered students face unique challenges. To provide effective services and supports, colleges and universities, policymakers, and advocates need reliable data about the rate of acceptance, graduation, and dropout rates. Just like we use data for other demographic groups, we can use this information to measure disparities and determine what services and supports work to improve outcomes. A good example is the recognition in the last century, that girls were significantly underrepresented in school athletics. In response, Congress passed Title IX, part of which required schools to collect data on the participation rates of girls. This gave policymakers the ability to first measure the effectiveness of Title IX in increasing opportunities for girls, and second, to hold educational institutions accountable for ensuring they are providing equal opportunities that encourage and support girls to pursue athletic activities. The Education Committee held an informational hearing on Title IX in the interim and used the statewide and national data to look at what was working in schools and how to do better in schools that had lower than average participation rates. We could not have had this conversation without reliable data. As we talk about how to support LGBT students in their academic pursuits, data about their participation and rates and dropout will be critical. When the idea was first brought to me, I did have some initial concerns about student privacy, but the questions, according to this bill, would be optional, and information collected after acceptance will be covered by FERPA, and the goal is to use the data to benefit students. There's a great panel here to talk to you today about why this bill is important. I hope you will give it your consideration, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Rep. Gelser. We'll certainly give it our consideration. Thank you for bringing it before us. And if there are questions right now for Rep. Gelser, fire away. Otherwise, she's got to get to another committee. Is that correct?
That's correct.
All right. Well, then,
let you go
and get the panel up here. I have four people signed up. I heard rumor that perhaps one of them, Stephen Leiter, who was just referenced, is not yet here. Is that correct? Okay. So let's have C.M. Hall, Lindsay Wilkinson, and Emma Calloway. Please. And I'll leave it up to you three to decide who goes first. Whoever goes first, please start by identifying yourself for the record.
Good morning. My name is C.M. Hall, and I work as faculty and staff at Western Oregon University, and I'm alumni from Western as well. I just wanted to say thank you so much for holding a hearing on this House bill. Thanks also for the opportunity for me to be able to testify in support. As I mentioned, I work at Western Oregon University. I also coordinate a federal grant focused on sign language interpreter education standards at Western, and I teach in the sign language interpreting degree program, as well as a course for the sociology department, a lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender studies course. And I've worked in higher education on and off for over 20 years, but consistently at Western for the last seven. And I'm also a proud member of the Board of Directors of Basic Rights Oregon, which is our state's leading advocacy organization for gay and transgender communities. We represent tens of thousands of Oregonians from every corner of this state, and we are strongly urging passage of this House bill. As explained in Representative Gelser's testimony, I'm not going to go into the specifics, but I'd like to just echo the importance. According to Too Afraid to Learn, a 2008 survey of over 3,500 Oregon college students, a hostile campus climate has a significant impact on gay and transgender students. 1 in 10 gay and transgender students took more than 5 years to graduate due to anti-LGBT sentiment. Over half of gay and transgender students concealed their sexual orientation on campus for fear of personal safety, discrimination, or rejection. And more than 60% of all students reported witnessing instances of homophobia, ranging from homophobic language to violence. I do a lot of public education at Western in a lot of different courses, health education courses, sociology, criminal justice courses in relation to LGBT terminology, sensitivity. And I work very closely with our LGBT student group. And I have seen progress over the last 20 years when I was an undergraduate student at the university coming out, but it still exists. And to be able to document and track efficacy and graduation rates and retention rates and having that option for students to give us that information about themselves, I think is really helpful for us to be able to continue to foster an educational environment. As university staff, this data collection matters to me both personally and professionally. I do want all students to get the support they need to thrive at Western. Faculty and staff strive to provide this support individually. Collecting this data on the experiences of students, faculty, and staff would help our institutional practices catch up to our individual practices. Clear, consistent data collection would allow Oregon colleges and universities to accurately assess and appropriately address the experience of gay, lesbian, bi, and transgender students, faculty, and staff. This House bill would allow students, faculty, and staff to identify their sexual orientation on these forms as an option, helping us collect demographic information without mandating collection. This House bill allows colleges and universities to replicate the successes and address disparities, and that strengthens, in my opinion, Oregon colleges for all of our students. Basic Rights Oregon, as I am representing them, supports this House bill, and we urge the committee to move it forward. Thank you for listening.
Good morning, Chair Harker and members of the committee. If it's all right with you, I'd like to testify and then be excused so that I can make it to another bill.
Certainly okay.
Thank you very much. My name is Emma Calloway. I'm the Legislative Director for the Oregon Student Association, and we have two student stories today that we're going to submit by written testimony, and I just wanted to share some of their stories on campus. The first is that one of our students doesn't really feel comfortable sharing her sexual orientation on campus, and she really struggled with the idea of telling you all about her story this morning. And I think that that is reflective of the fact that although we've come very far, I think that our campuses are still not necessarily collecting the data on our campuses about our students, and students don't feel like their sexual orientation and their experiences related to that are something that they can talk about openly, is something that the campus wants to know about them. And it's interesting how data collection can really be such a simple way of acknowledging the important experiences that are, an everyday experience of our LGBT students on our campuses. We think that this data will be very helpful in a number of ways academically, as we've already heard, and we also think that this will be helpful in our healthcare centers on campuses as well, in terms of actually like improving health outcomes and helping people get to class and be healthy, productive members of our community. So I will leave you with that and just say that this bill is very important to our LGBT students on campus. The Oregon Student Association has an LGBT justice arm of our organization, which is made up of LGBT leaders across all of our states, across our state and across all our campuses, and they are very supportive of this bill. So thank you very much for the opportunity to testify, and we hope that you do consider your support and a yes vote on 2995.
Emma, let me ask one question before you leave, and if somebody else wants to answer it, that's fine, but I want you here just in case. Given what you've just said about the reluctance of some of these folks, some of these students to talk about, to talk openly about their sexual orientation, do you think that if we provide this box where it can be checked, that we will get meaningful data? We'll get some data. And if you could include in the answer any reference to what's gone on in other states or nationally, that'd be great.
Great. Thank you, Chair Harker and members of the committee. I think that this, that checking the box will still be optional, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And so students will choose whether to out their sexual orientation. But these forms are kept in, some forms are kept confidentially, and those students would have information about when those forms are confidential. Some forms are kept publicly, and then students would have information about when their sexual orientation would be public to members of the other, the rest of the community. So I think having that choice allows students to have an early conversation in their development and in their education about when they do want to be open and out, and when they do want to be able to help the university, you know, move through that part of their of the university's history and their institution.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Sounds like you better head to another committee.
Thanks.
I'll just respond quickly to that question as well before I get started with that.
Introduce yourself.
Sorry, my name is Lindsay Wilkinson. I'm an assistant professor of sociology at Portland State University. And I think that's a really great question kind of methodologically, but I just quickly would say that really any surveys, all surveys that we have are optional. So I think that's an issue that's really inherent in any sort of survey methodology that we have. But definitely an issue, and particularly maybe an issue as we consider the format of the questions and what the question looks like, and also informing people of confidentiality, and et cetera. So yeah, as stated, I am an assistant professor at Portland State University. I teach courses related to gender and sexualities, education, and quantitative methods, and perhaps more relevant to this discussion. I also conduct quantitative research on the well-being of sexual minority youth and young adults. And unfortunately, data that allows researchers such as myself to assess the educational outcomes, experiences, and needs of gay youth and young adults, but particularly at the post-secondary level, is in really high demand and is really lacking. We really just have, there's quite a dearth of this data out there, data available. And even much more so in the case of transgender young adults. We really just don't have a lot of data related to transgender young adults. So that's why I'm here today urging you to pass House Bill 2995 to provide Oregon the opportunity to be at the forefront in the use of evidence-based research to serve gay and transgender students in higher ed. So while gay and transgender college students are often quite resilient and successful, this population, as others have suggested, is also at greater risk of academic disengagement, poor educational, occupational, and health outcomes, etc. I think all of this has been very much well documented in the research. So understanding the needs and experiences of gay and transgender college students through better data collection and analysis will enable us to use our scarce resources to better serve this population. So I first started in this area of research. I used data, the National Longitudinal Study of Adolescent Health, which is actually the first nationally representative sample of youth and young adults that included any information about sexual orientation and their educational experiences outcomes. So I'm specifically GPA, dropout rates, high school graduation, whether or not they go to college, whether they stay in college, et cetera, et cetera. There's just not a lot of data out there that connects these two, measures of sexual orientation and measures of educational outcomes, progress, retention, et cetera. So we've really learned a lot using Out Health over the years, particularly as it relates to K-12 schools, policy related to transgender youth, gay youth and K-12 schools. But again, we just don't have a lot of information about what happens to these youth once they get into college, kind of besides whether or not they go. I work with a group called American Educational Research Association, who has really brought together a bunch of social scientists and researchers such as myself, and we're currently in the process of putting together a report urging policymakers such as you at the federal level to include these questions on on current surveys, so surveys that already exist, that have already been funded by the government. So to include really simple questions about sexual orientation on these surveys to get some data that we really need that we could really use. And again, this is a relatively simple and cost-effective way of collecting this important data, so using the surveys that are currently in existence. So much of the current knowledge that we have about gay and transgender students in post-secondary experiences is based on small convenience samples, are often plagued with methodological issues, selection bias, small cell sizes, lack of a comparison group, et cetera, which really call into question the validity and reliability of these findings. So if we're going to use data to try to serve these students, it seems like we should try to use data that is most reliable and valid as possible, given I acknowledge that there are methodological issues in any way we decide to do this. So if we put these questions on some of these forms in institutions of higher ed in Oregon, we basically have the opportunity to not get a sample, but actually a census. And again, of course, it depends on who chooses to identify or not. But we have the opportunity, a really awesome opportunity, to potentially have a census of these students and not a sample, and not be plagued with many of these methodological issues that we have been in the past. And again, I'm not going to repeat what some of the other panelists have suggested, but there are some really important implications of this and some really important lessons that we can learn to better serve transgender and gay college students in Oregon. So again, I urge you to pass House Bill 2995 to kind of lead the way in accessing, collecting this data at the state level. So thank you.
Thank you. And
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
Ask him some specific questions.
Of course. Take it away, Rep. Greenlee.
You're talking about matching the survey data now with other data. Is that right?
I'm not specifically saying that that's something we would do in Oregon.
The purpose of this is to get you the data so you can match it with outcome data and other data. I mean, you're making a research case to argue for having this data available for research, is that?
Yes, well, depending on what forms the questions would be asked on and what forms are currently in existence, yes, the opportunity would be available, as we do for other underserved minority populations.
So, there were some issues, I assumed, I'm hearing, heard some issues about confidentiality and the concern that the data, well, given on a form for use, I mean, my assumption would be that it wouldn't be specifically identifiable to an individual. You're arguing that the value of the data is that you can link it, you as a researcher can link it with other data. Does that cause confidentiality concerns?
I mean, it would be similar to anything else we would do in terms of race, ethnicity, or gender, and it would be at an aggregate level, so you wouldn't be able to...
Well, gender is not a very confidential issue, I mean, in its ordinary terms, so I don't think I mind if you know my gender is male. I might mind if you know my sexual orientation if I gave it in what I considered was a confidential manner. Does this bill make that data available for anybody to access?
I don't know if anyone else wants to speak to this.
I can answer that question after I read my and introduce myself, if you'd like.
We'll step back.
Does that work for you?
Yep.
Okay, and I am willing to bet that you are Stephen Leiter. Is that true? Okay, so sure. Why don't you grab a microphone and identify yourself through the microphone. And
my name is Stephen Leiter, and I am here today to testify in support of House Bill 2995 regarding gathering demographic data concerning sexual orientation in higher education. Presently, I'm a graduate student at Oregon State University in the Master's in Interdisciplinary Studies program. My three areas of study focus on women's studies, ethnic studies, and adult higher education. My research focuses on the experiences of lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer students seeking to replace lost familial funding after being dispossessed by parents following the student coming out, which is the self-disclosing of their sexual orientation or gender identity, or being outed, someone other than the student revealing their sexual orientation or gender identity to family. For 6 years prior to beginning my graduate studies, I was professional faculty at Oregon State as director of LGBT outreach and services within the Office of Intercultural Student Services. For 8 years prior to moving to Corvallis, I worked as at UCLA's LGBT Campus Resource Center as a student affairs officer. Altogether, I've worked in the field of student affairs in American higher education for 15 years. I proposed to my representative, Sarah Gelser, that she sponsor the legislation that ultimately became House Bill 2995 because, as a result of my graduate research and my work as a graduate student affairs professional, I came to realize there is virtually no demographic data anywhere in higher education literature about LGBTQ college students. In contrast, we have large bodies of knowledge on many other student populations, including Black and African American students, Latina, Latino, Asian Pacific Islander, Native American, Indian, women, parent, graduate, commuter, veteran, older than average, non-traditional, community college, athlete, engaged, disengaged, low socioeconomic status, privileged, gifted, profoundly gifted, mental health challenged, disabled, differently abled, first generation, returning, transfer, reverse transfer, international, rural, urban, suburban, remedial, and other college student populations. These bodies of knowledge grow larger by the day. This is not the case with our body of knowledge about LGBT students. This dearth of demographic data severely hinders any kind of empirical research from being conducted about this largely invisible student population. Consequently, we have no idea how successful our efforts at recruitment and retention of LGBTQ students are, nor do we in the Oregon higher education community have any idea about the graduation or dropout rates of LGBT college students within the state. These are the most basic evaluative units by which success or failure of access and equity judgments can be made in our education systems, and yet we can't provide answers to these simple questions and most basic questions about admission and completion rates. At a time when we in higher education are being asked to justify our budgets and prove the success of our education programs, this is an important shortcoming within the system, one that is overcome by passage of this simple piece of legislation. It enables us to gather data that will help us to evaluate and assess the success or failure of our current programming efforts on behalf of one of the state's most underserved and invisible college student populations. Thank you for this opportunity to testify. Again, I urge your support for House Bill 2995.
Thank you, Stephen. And I think you wanted to return to the question that Rep. Greenlick had asked?
Yes. At Oregon State, one of the questions on the admissions documents is the option to identify the student as male, female, or transgender, and to self-explain what that means to the student. So we're already asking that particular question at Oregon State, and a number of people in student affairs are already working on adding additional information. This bill gives us the opportunity to gather this kind of data either in the aggregate or individually. And it would come under the protection of FERPA, like all other information that's gathered. In fact, it would become protected even from the parents of the student at the time that the student matriculates. So the suggestion is that the student be asked this information at the time that they actually join the university, and that is when FERPA kicks in and protects that information.
And protects it from researchers? Or sociology professors?
That remains to be seen. Yes, that would be up to each individual campus and the student, because the student has the option of answering that question or not answering that question. That would be up to the individual student.
One quick follow-up. Would the student know that that would be accessible to others? They came to answer the question?
For the most part, students are not as concerned as people our age are about being asked that question nowadays.
Well, we had testimony that they are.
Yes, that's true, but not all students, and that's why this information would be optional on the form. If you're concerned, you're not going to answer that question because you know it's optional. Additionally, we know that The primary time which young adults come out would be between the ages of the beginning of high school and the end of college. They don't all come out at the age of 18. Some of them may come out at 19, 20, 21. They may not come out until they actually graduate. So this is a body of numbers that will change frequently, because there will be students who come to the university or the college without having thought about their sexual orientation or their gender identity. The exploration of those identities usually takes place in the college or university, and a whole new understanding, self-understanding, comes about as a result of taking classes, discussing new concepts and ideas that had never been broached in high school or amongst family members or even in the larger community.
I have my answer. Thank you.
Okay, very good. Rep. Gallegos, one question, and then we've got one more person to testify on this, and I see that Rep. Witt is here for the next two. So.
Thank you. Thank you for being here. I just want to comment on the fact that I think what you're bringing to this committee is a critical and significant step forward in terms of cultural competence. And what it's really doing, to me, that the larger significance has to do with really bringing the state of Oregon into the 21st century. I think that it really is an important step in terms of recognizing a stigmatized group, a group that, I mean, we still have racism in this country. We still have prejudice against groups of color, but it really is sexual minorities that have the highest rate of prejudice currently. And so I think that as I said, this bill has much more significance than simply data collection. It is providing recognition of a disenfranchised group, and in that is an empowering of that group, a group that continues to have high rates of suicide among teenagers and young people, a group that has high rates of substance abuse, addictions, and all sorts of things that come from being a stigmatized and disenfranchised group. So I appreciate this bill coming forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative.
Okay, thank you, panel. Jody Weiser, you want to come up and testify on this as well? Brad, are you in a time crunch?
I'm fine, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I guess Vice Chair Harker and committee. I want to give you a personal story.
Identify yourself.
Jody Weiser, and I'm here as myself, not as taxpayer in Oregon. So I wish our society was where it is now, 22 years ago, when my former daughter-in-law entered college, because she didn't come out until after 10 years of marriage and the divorce. And she dropped out of medical school within 6 months of the marriage. And what I saw is two wonderful people who were struggling to try to be a couple, and two people who are so much happier now with new partners. And I think that just being faced with the question on the form, and what happens when you start recognizing other people around you, is really helpful for people to figure out who they are. I have a doctor friend who was 65 when he started cross-dressing at work. That was a really long time to have hid who he was. And I think it's really important to make it more comfortable for people to be the people they are, because they're going to be much better at contributing to the society if they are comfortable. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions, comments on this subject? If not, thanks to all who testified. I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2995 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3245. Victoria, if you'd like to kick that off, and Representative Witt, if you would get ready to speak with us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3245 requires inmates participating in an apprenticeship program operated by Oregon Corrections Enterprises or Department of Corrections to be under direct supervision of department employee who is licensed or experienced in trade or occupation. Prohibits supervisor from also being an inmate. Declares an emergency and is effective on passage.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm State Representative Brad Witt from Oregon's House District 31, and appearing before you this morning in favor of House Bill 3245. This is a bill that requires the licensure of supervisors who oversee inmates that are working as apprentices or journeymen in a corrections or corrections-related program. The licensure that the bill addresses must be in the trade or occupation in which the inmate or inmates are working, or alternatively, the supervisor's experience must be such that it would qualify him or her to serve on a local joint apprenticeship committee. The purpose, of course, is that the person, the supervisor, is experienced in that craft or trade. The bill is necessary because inmates often work in technically challenging and complicated projects. And without knowledgeable oversight, the inmates can and do make costly mistakes, either through innocent errors or sometimes deliberate sabotage. And I can think that I imagine that you can see where this would be very important to have that kind of knowledgeable oversight to make sure that these errors don't occur and to protect the interests of taxpayers and, in fact, the Department of Corrections. And with that, I would urge your favorable action on House Bill 3245. And if you have questions about some of these costly mistakes, I think there will be people that will be following me that could highlight some good ones. So with that, Mr. Chairman, thank you for the opportunity, and I would be happy to defer questions to someone more knowledgeable on the bill that perhaps than I.
Thank you, Representative Witt. I see no pressing questions.
Well, so, this one is one.
I tried to get you out of here and defer those questions.
To answer one question.
Thank you.
People under any other apprenticeship program would be under the supervision of somebody you're calling for in this bill. Is that correct?
That is correct, Representative Greenlee, through the chair. That's correct. And the issue here is one of making sure that the supervisor that's overseeing the inmate has that licensure. So you're correct, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Of course.
That was
thank
great.
You. Thank you very much. We
thank
do
you
have
very much.
Three other people here signed up to
thank
testify.
You
so I would call up Ron Thompson, Tim Woolery, I think, and Brian Bell Q. And Mary Bodkin. I see. I missed it. I went straight to this. My apologies,
Chair. No, that's okay. For the record, I am Mary Bodkin, representing the American Federation of State County Municipal Employees, and we represent the folks who work in Oregon's prisons doing the day-to-day operations of keeping the prisons functioning, making sure the doors open and close, making sure that the heat comes on and goes off, and making sure that things are in good working condition. This bill has been introduced because we are experiencing more and more having inmate work crews who are doing technically challenging work being supervised only by security staff and not being supervised by individuals who have a working knowledge of the work that the inmates are doing. I am not going to go into great detail because I have folks on both sides of me who know much more about this than I do, but I want to remind the committee that inmates, by definition, are individuals who have spent a lifetime making poor decisions and making bad choices. So when we look at what happens inside the prison system, One might ask, why would an inmate do anything that would cause damage? If that was a logical question that had a logical response, perhaps the prisons would not be full. So with that, I will step away and allow the two gentlemen with me, Ron Thompson, who works at the State River Facility in Ontario, and Tim Woolery, who is my colleague and worked in the prison system for 18 years before he became my colleague. And the two of them can give you the background and let you know why we had the bill introduced and the frustration that we've had at trying to resolve the issues.
Very good.
Good morning, Chair Harker and honorable members of the committee. My name is Tim Woolery, for the record, as introduced by Mary. Thank you. As she said, I worked with the department for 18 years as a correctional officer, and I've now transitioned to be the representative over not only the security unit, which is 1,800 people in 11 facilities, but also the security plus people that she mentioned, the nurses, the counselors, the physical plant workers, 1,200 of those. My experience with this issue is I worked at a minimum facility, and that minimum facility does not have any licensed tradesmen. However, work needs to be done. So where there's work needing to be done, work gets done, not necessarily always as it should be done. That happens at other minimum facilities throughout the state as well. The medium and higher facilities have licensed tradespeople. The minimums do not. Occasionally, the department tries to get work done that needs to be done through the use of inmate labor. We are supportive of the apprenticeship programs. Those apprenticeship programs exist in the medium and higher facilities which have licensed tradespeople. However, once the inmate receives his license through that program or comes to the department already licensed in a particular trade, the department likes to use those inmates to get work done, and we oppose that. So, and it's not just a matter of maybe the inmate of his own violation sabotaging something. That inmate could be pressured by other inmates to do such work. So, in our opinion, anytime an inmate is working on particularly licensed trades work, they need to be supervised by a person that is equally licensed to or higher. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, ladies and gentlemen, my name is Ron Thompson. I come from Ontario. I work at a Snake River Correctional Institution. I'm in the physical plant out there, and I do air conditioning refrigeration work for the department. I'm also the statewide president of the Security Plus group for AFSCME, and I represent all the physical plant people and other non-correctional officers across the state and all the institutions, almost all the institutions. We're bringing this bill because, as has been stated earlier, the apprenticeship program within the mediums is a very good program. It's a well-oiled machine. It works very well. It does give our inmates an opportunity to gain some licensure, some experience, some knowledge, so that when they get out, and all inmates do eventually get out, they have some kind of a knowledge to find a living, working job when they get out, so they don't go back out to their old ways and find their way back into their prison system, which is what we don't want. So kudos to the apprenticeship program and the people that run it within the institutions. The inmates who complete the apprenticeship program get a electrical license. I'm going to focus on the electrical license because that's where I feel the biggest problem is. They get a license that's almost a journey level license in electrical work. They cannot do residential electrical work, but they can do everything else. It's a plant maintenance worker license, I believe is what it's called. So these inmates get these licenses if they pass the test. As always, inmates end up going to minimum facilities. They go to places like Powder River, Shutter Creek, Warner Creek, Columbia River. These small institutions that usually stand alone, they don't have a big, large, medium institution with them, typically do not have physical plant electricians in them. Or in a lot of cases, they don't even have anybody there that has a license. As has been mentioned earlier, sometimes things go wrong. Sometimes they need something. The proper way is to call facilities, and facilities should send an electrician down. But we all know that work needs to get done, and there's an inmate there that's licensed. So it's just real easy to sometimes use an inmate who's there with a license to do a job that they don't need to be doing. So because there's no one really there that knows what to do, a lot of this stuff happens on weekends and nights. A correctional officer is assigned to do the work. Correctional officers are highly trained. They are very professional employees at doing correctional work, supervising inmates in a non-physical plant type environment. I don't feel I'm qualified to do their job, so I don't think they would likewise be qualified to do my job, my whole electrical license. But anyway, they're assigned to supervise inmates doing some of these repair work or, in some cases, new work, whatever it is. They don't necessarily know what it is that the inmate is doing. They may not have the skill or the knowledge to know what they're doing. And the inmate goes forth and does whatever it is he's told to do. You've been given some photos of some things that's been wrong, whether accidentally or maliciously, you know, sometimes we don't know. But inmates, a lot of times, will just take shortcuts. They'll do whatever it is they're told to do, and they'll do it however they can do it with whatever they can find to do it with. And if it's not up to code, it's a violation. It's against the law. So what we're hoping with this bill is that when inmates are used that are holding an electrical license or actually any kind of a license, we want them supervised by a licensed trained person within the institution who knows what they're doing, a licensed person who has a license of equal or higher value. I have a limited electrician license, which means I can't do new construction, but I can do anything less than new construction. I can replace existing and repair existing. I should be one that would be supervising an inmate up to that level. If you're wanting them to do something new, you would need a journeyman license. So an inmate should not be working on something without supervision of someone of equal or higher license. It's a safety, a safety and security situation within the institutions. You know, through this a mistake. You know, you don't want your you don't want something major going wrong in a prison, regardless of whether it's a minimum or a medium. So,
if I can just add one thing to the testimony that's been given, one of the examples that was given to me was that a number of inmates hold what they call a low energy license, which allows them to work on computer equipment. And computer equipment is a direct access to a lot of data. And what we don't need is we don't need inmates accessing background data and information about other inmates or about staff, and if they're not properly supervised, that's possible. And so, you know, this is a bill that really is designed to sort of keep the security systems in place and to guarantee that folks have some ability to trust that this will that it will work well. So anyway, I'm rambling, and I will stop. Thank
Those
you.
Those were good points. Thanks to the entire panel, and thanks for adding that at the end. Yes, Professor.
I teach criminal justice. I was in law enforcement before, so you get to hear, and they're anecdotal, but you hear some interesting stories. One of the stories was at a prison outside of the state of Oregon where the inmate was charged with fixing the lock system. And then the inmate made an extra little electrical operation so that he could open the doors when, you know, people weren't watching. I mean, the potential is certainly there. I also want to go back to what you said about, Mr. Chair, follow up.
Yes, of course.
Okay. I want to go back to what you said about electrical stuff. I imagine that if it was done incorrectly and then there was a fire or some other problem, that the state would be civilly liable for that?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Of course. And Rep. Gilliam?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just briefly to respond to my good friend, Representative Gorsuch. yes, a little odd that inmates are doing the locks, but not as odd as legislators doing the laws. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I knew I shouldn't have called on you. Wow. Thank you. Thank you, panel.
Always a pleasure to be on.
No other questions
panel.
Right now. We have, I think it's Brian Belkew. Yes, Brian Belkew.
Thank you, sir.
the citizens are just dripping. Gillian gets up early.
Whenever you're ready, sir.
He slept in the committee room.
Vice Chair Harker, members of the House Committee on Higher Education Workforce Development. I am Brian Bilek, Westside Institutions Administrator with the Oregon Department of Corrections. I'm here to provide information on House Bill 3245 as it relates to the department. As written, HB 3245 requires the department and Oregon Corrections Enterprise ensure licensed or experienced trade, occupation, corrections employees supervise inmates participating as an apprenticeship or journey worker in apprenticeship programs. Currently, the department contracts with the Treasure Valley Community College for two programs at the Snake River Correctional Institution, Ontario. 14 inmates currently participate in pre-apprentice carpentry program and are supervised by two Bureau of Labor and Industries staff and it's approved level, journey level TVCC staff, Treasure Valley Community College staff. We also have a cabinet-making apprenticeship program at SRCI for up to four inmates that will be supervised by Treasure Valley Community College staff. In addition, DOC is currently working on a contract to bring the Oregon Limited Building Maintenance Electrician Apprenticeship Program to the Coffee Creek facility in Wilsonville. Once in place, an inmate's on-the-job training will be supervised by DOC employees and the related training through the ORL-BME as required by BOLI. As drafted, HB 3245 requires a DOC or OC employee licensed or experienced in appropriate trade or occupation to supervise in an apprenticeship program like the carpentry program at SRCI and the proposed ORLMBME at Coffee Creek Correctional Facility. This requirement would eliminate or dramatically limit the department's apprenticeship programs and future opportunities for such, thereby limited skilled trades opportunities for inmates. Some additional information, the Department of Corrections, 14 institutions were surveyed, and those institutions that have an apprenticeship program have licensed staff directly supervise those inmates in a DOC physical plant-based apprenticeship program. There are no DOC physical plant-based apprenticeship programs being managed in the standalone minimum facilities, and the bill as written would not have any impact to those facilities. On occasion, the minimum custody institutions house an inmate with certain trade licensure. In discussions with the State Building Codes Division, it is the DOC's position that an inmate possessing a certified license could perform repair and maintenance work under the Master Permit Program without being directly supervised by a DOC staff member with the same or higher level of certification. Under the Master Permit Program, the work completed by the licensed inmate would be inspected by a qualified and properly licensed individual to ensure the work was completed correctly and properly recorded. If this bill passes, the DOC would have to pursue hiring additional maintenance staff with appropriate licensure for our minimum custody facilities or consider using outside contractors to complete the work in place of licensed inmates or DOC staff. Thank you for your time today. I'd be happy to answer questions you may have.
Colleagues, any questions?
We would, first of all, Mr. Bilek, I apologize getting your name wrong. With regard to the costs, do we have an estimate of the additional costs? I haven't seen any.
I don't think we've done a fiscal on this yet.
Chairman Demereau and committee members, Vice Chair Harker, we'd have to review the number of incidents we've used for the minimum custody facilities, the frequency of the work that needs to be done with the licensed trade staff person, and we have to cost that out.
Rep. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, and I guess I would defer to Mr. Vice Chair, who's been here in your absence and so forth. I wonder if there's a way to make a delineation in what the bill is asking here regarding the type of oversight and the type of apprenticeships, let's just say, that are in play here. I mean, carpentry-type training is much different in my view, and I think in the fire life safety view of the commercial codes and so forth, than electrical work is, than plumbing can be and so forth. Is there a way potentially to delineate between the type of apprenticeships or activities that inmates are involved in, requiring greater oversight for some, but not changing it for all, would just be a thought. And I don't know whether that's been considered or not.
To the best of my knowledge, that hasn't been discussed yet. I would defer to other people to make those decisions. The only part of what I've seen in this testimony that's familiar to me is the Cat 5 cable.
Right.
So in terms of deciding about the subtleties of apprenticeship and licensure between electricians and carpenters, et cetera, I'd be open to the conversation. I think we should consider it.
Yeah, first of all, let me say I apologize. I had to be next door testifying on another bill, and so I'm clueless on this issue. But I would be happy to consult with the parties and see if we can see if an amendment's in order, and certainly we'll have that conversation before we bring this bill back before you, mm-hmm. colleagues.
Sounds good.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much, sir. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3245. And I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3472. Esteemed Representative Whitman. And Parker, are you?
Go for it. Yeah, two people.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, just a thought for you. This may not be comforting, but I've been here most of the morning, and I feel more clueless than you do. I just hope that's helpful.
Yeah, that's a softball.
We are all going to exercise great restraint, Gilliam. So.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, honorable colleagues, vice chairs. For the record, I'm Gene Wisnett, State Representative, House District 53. And I bring to you today, this committee, a bill that I'm glad you're hearing, and I appreciate your hearing. And it comes sponsored by three of the most concerned members of your group to try to hold down tuition for our students, which is part of this committee's goal. Simple bill. We're just asking both the representatives that joined me on this bill. We noticed that several states are looking at freezing tuition. It's tough, and Mr. Chair of the committee administrator, we have Mr. McDonald from Washington is going to testify, Western Oregon, excuse me, and Mrs. Calloway from Oregon Students Association. What we're asking here is we're not directing it at this time. We're just asking that the HEC look at what other states are doing. I would ask the members, you can Google universities freezing tuition for 4 years. And there are risks, and Mr. McDonald will talk about those risks and how Western Oregon modified what they're trying to do to hold down tuition. But just if you Google universities freezing tuition for 4 years, you'll find that many universities are doing this. Several universities, Illinois, Georgia, and elsewhere, have done this. Texas is looking at it. You can get a whole list of tuition freezes. Some do for 1 year or for 2 years, and some do it for 4 years. We've been one of the hot topics of this legislative session is contracts. So if I send my son or my grandson to a university and I can contract with you for a tuition amount of money, I think that's something we could look at. So again, I appreciate the chair's short notice. Three members said that's worth talking about, and that's what we're asking you to do today is talk about it and even maybe working it and asking the HEC to study this. Those are our professionals, and maybe even Mr. Chair, we have a lot of great ideas, your idea and other ones, that maybe all this needs to be studied by this group instead of maybe other ways. So thank you very much for hearing the bill, and I'm not an expert, I'm just a plain old legislator from Oregon. If you have any questions, I'll be glad to try to answer them.
Thank you, Rep. Wisnan. You may be plain, but you're not that old. Yes, Vice Chair Harker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sitting between you two, I wish I had a better joke to crack. But I want to be sure that the committee understands the fact that I'm not down there with Representative Wisnett does not imply anything about my lack of enthusiasm for this bill. He proposed it to me. I thought he deserved the credit for being down there, doing the main presentation along with the other two people who are going to testify. But it certainly merits our serious consideration, I think. So thank you for asking me to be part of it.
Thank you for agreeing to do it. And also my friend, Mr. Representative.
And okay. Does anybody have any questions about the bill? It seems very straightforward.
Can we work it today?
No.
And Mr. Chair, I would encourage all the committee members to sign up. It's what we're trying to do is call down tuition. Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Rick Wisnett. Okay, so I'll call up David McDonald and Emma Calloway, please. Thank you, Mr. McDonald, for coming over. You know, the Western Promise was indeed an innovative and brave effort that Western Oregon committed to several years ago. And we'll be curious to hear how it's going and whether, you know, to what extent this is an idea that should spread.
Thank you very much. For the record, my name is Dave McDonald. I am the Associate Provost at Western Oregon University. Chair Dembrough, members of the committee, in 2007, the university did, in fact, implement the Western Tuition Promise. The promise was very simple in its goal, and that was to provide incoming freshman students from Oregon a four-year guarantee that their tuition would not increase. It also had a clause that allowed for our students who transferred to Western from another college or university to have a locked-in tuition as well. That was prorated based on the number of credits they had accumulated at their prior institutions. What we have found over the course of about 5 years of this program is it has achieved many of its goals. It has provided students the security of not having tuition increases. For first-generation students, going to college is a large enough challenge in and of itself. There are a lot of unexpected speed bumps along the way that they are not prepared to deal with, including the sudden tuition increases. Oregon has been very fortunate that it hasn't experienced the type of tuition increases other states have, like California, which had for several years 30% increases on an annual basis. The tuition promise protected our students from about the 6-7% average increase that most state institutions had to put in place during those years. It also provided students a cumulative savings of about $1,000, is what we estimated the average student who started in 2007 and graduated 4 years later was able to realize. The promise is a four-year package so that at the end of 4 years, students will have a tuition increase. The four-year period was put in place to create an incentive for the students to maximize their time and credits earned and graduate within 4 years. The major caution we gave to the State Board of Higher Education at that time, as well as to the legislature, was that the promise could be continued only if our funding from the state did not decrease. And unfortunately, we all know that promise or that condition actually has been very problematic for us. So in 2012, we changed the promise to what we call a tuition choice. And the choice really became, in many ways, a nice addition to the program. It allowed for students to come in with a four-year guarantee if they chose the promise, or to have a what we call the traditional plan, where they would have tuition increases on an annual basis, but the traditional plan would start at a lower tuition rate. So the way we have paraphrased it to simplify it for students is that the tuition promise is the save later option. The traditional plan is the save now option, where the students have a front-end lower tuition, but it will go up on an annual basis. The major challenge that any type of tuition guarantee program carries with it is the fact that as state support for institutions decline, we are forced to resort to tuition increases to offset that. Western has only the opportunity to increase tuition on one group of students at a time, our incoming freshmen and transfer students. The remainder of our students are locked in at a set rate, and it really limits the degree of freedom we have in which to compensate for declining state revenues. So that is a major challenge with this type of a program. We do review the program annually to make sure that it is financially prudent for us to continue it. And I will admit to the committee that we have had very serious conversations in the past about continuing this program because, again, of the 25% decrease in state funding we've received since 2007. If those continue or those declines continue, programs like the Promise really are not sustainable.
Okay.
Yes. Thank you, Ms. McDonald. Emma, let's hear from you, and then I think we probably have questions of Mr. McDonald and you.
Great. Thank you very much. Good morning, Chair Dembro and members of the committee. My name is Emma Calloway. I'm the Legislative Director for the Oregon Student Association. And when I brought this bill from Representative Wiesnett back to the leadership of our organization, they were enthusiastically supportive of this idea. I think the idea of doing a lot more research about how we can talk about tuition stability, how we can talk about financial planning, how we can talk about being prepared for the level of debt one can take on is a really exciting conversation. We're encouraged by the fact that our legislators, even in times of dwindling state funding, would be interested in affordability from this angle. We appreciate that. I wanted to talk about a couple things. I would say that our students at Western are probably the most tenaciously supportive of this because our student government students at Western really believe that this is something that retains their first-generation student, does a better job of retaining students of color, and I think Western Oregon University is a real example of creating a welcoming place for communities of color. And I think that the tuition promise, anecdotally, we believe, plays a big part in increasing that recruitment and retention. Let's see. I think that the sticker shock that you mentioned is a key part for our students. Incoming freshmen and first-generation students do have a lot of sticker shock around post-secondary education, and it may be a reason they choose not to go or choose not to complete. Something that the Western Promise does is be very clear about what that education will cost in the long run. And we think that being able to hold that tuition price steady for 4 years, the students who do choose that, I'd be interested to hear from Western whether there's a shorter time to completion for students who utilize the Western Promise. And we have, you know, lots of questions about how this is used as a recruitment and retention tool and a completion tool, which is something that we hear on a regular basis, all of you talking about, is how do we get students through and completing their education. So for those reasons, we ask for your support of House Bill 3472, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Yes, Rep. Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if we do this, obviously, if you move this, these are subjects for the study. Mm-hmm. But I did want to mention this, particularly with two great testifiers. I particularly understand the difficulty that Western has if this body pulls the plug on 25% of your budget. I don't know if that could be considered a promise. Maybe it is, from your perspective. A promise is a promise. But I think one of the issues here would be to say to students, a promise is a promise for 4 years. Now, you may have to make some adjustments. Private schools have done this sort of thing. I've seen it work very well. And their budgets are subject to all kinds of changes or whatever. But my point is, I would rather see it, you look at it as, if there needs to be an adjustment, it won't be to the freshman class that you've promised the guarantee, it will be to that next class coming after them. I just that whole idea of a guaranteed promise, I think, is really important, at least in my understanding of how this bill would go forward. You don't have to comment, but if you have something, that'd be great.
Yes, Chair Dembro, Representative Gilliam, that's exactly how we do operate the program, so that when you do come in as a freshman, we lock your tuition in. We did put in the agreement a clause that would allow us to change that if the legislature reduces funding. We have chosen and found ways not to have to exercise that clause to date, so that what we have happened is that the class of 13 entering freshman has a higher tuition rate than does a class of 12, and again, than the class of 11. The big challenge for us has been, because of the reduction in state funding, the incremental increase for new freshman classes have been so large that we do believe it's created a sticker shock on the front end for students that have actually prevented a number of students from entering the institution because they view our price as being so high on the front end.
And if I can follow up, just to clarify, the way the program works, the initial, that first year cost is higher than it is at the other regional universities, right? Because, you know, the goal is to then hold it at that level, and so to, you know, include the assumption that there will at least be inflationary costs. increases.
Chair Deborah, you are correct. It is higher, and that's been a problem for us in terms of marketing the institution when over half of our students are first generation and over half of our students receiving Pell Grants. That initial price can be an impediment to entry.
Thank you. Vice Chair Harker.
One of the questions that I have that I can't pull out of the recesses of my memory here is about fees, how fees have changed at your institution versus the others, because as somebody who's just about to make my last payment for tuition, my son's tuition, I've watched that rise and fees rise like mad. So have, if you could comment on that, and you too perhaps.
Certainly. Chair Dembro, Vice Chair Harker, members of the committee, fees are outside the tuition promise, and they're outside for two reasons. The incidental fee portion of the fees are student-controlled, and certainly for the institution to impose a restriction on that, I think abridges a real growth opportunity and leadership responsibility of our student body. As an institution, we actually had some of the simplest fee structures in the system for many years and continue to have a very simplified fee structure. The biggest fee driver for us has been student health insurance, which is a major challenge for us on a number of reasons. But as a whole, the student fee portion, the largest portion is controlled by the students through the incidental fee, and it does sit outside of this particular structure. And by the way, congratulations on the last tuition payment, too.
Really?
Yes, sir.
Chair Dembro, I'd like to speak to Representative Harker's question as well. One of the things that I think Oregon has done well is that we rolled in the majority of fees compared to almost any other state around the country. So we really only have five or six fees that are outside of tuition, whereas you know, other academic programs around the country have individual fees per major and per classes that you take. All those fees were rolled in. And so that is an issue that has been addressed and is part of the Western Promise, because the majority of fees have been rolled into tuition. And to your other question about, you know, we were talking about the initial sticker shock of Western Oregon University, I'd be interested to have the HEC have a conversation about whether, if all institutions participated or at least had an option of some sort of promise, whether that would help students make a decision across all the institutions and would be able to actually say, oh, okay, all institutions have a promise. These are the different price options that are available to me, and it might help with some of that sticker shock at Western and encourage more students to participate in something like a promise. Thank you.
All right, thank you both for...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the testimony. I think the conversation we had showed how this looks like it's something we need to have. And I think Ms. Calloway's question to you, Provost McDonald, about has it led to more people getting in 4 years? If you can comment quickly on that or get us that information, I think, because, again, we're trying to get them through in 4 years as cheap as possible with quality education. So.
Chair Dembro, Representative Wisnett, the anecdotal information I'll give you is that last year we had the largest graduating class of students from Western Oregon in our 150-plus year history. Certainly part of that was in response to the type of things like the promise that we've put in place to increase graduation numbers and graduation rates.
Thank you. Rep. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And a quick question for you. I'm wondering, when you took the bill back to the students, were they most excited because they saw Rep. Wisnett's name on the bill or Rep. Gilliam's?
What am I, chopped liver?
The marquee name. Mr. McDonald, I'm wondering, and I totally appreciate what you said about, you know, Western wanting to make a promise to its students, but then the state kind of reneging on its promise, if you will, of adequate state support for higher ed. And unfortunately, I don't think we're making any additional progress in that area with both budgets that are on the table today, the governor's proposal as well as the co-chairs. And we put a lot more focus into K-12, certainly, but we continue to treat community colleges and our OUS system as afterthoughts, and I think that's tragic. I'm wondering, though, from your perspective at Western, would it be more attractive, or would it make the funding of it, would this promise work be more accessible and more lasting if, let's say, you had other participants in that program with you? For instance, let's just say all the regionals could adopt that, to where if Western had a little uptick in year one, all the others would too. It would be a common experience, if you will, to where you wouldn't be the outlier, but it would be more of a common experience out there that could potentially remove that stigma that you might have in year one and so forth. But have you had those kind of conversations with other presidents around the state regarding that?
Chair Denbrough, Representative Johnson, a couple responses. One is that we're always reluctant to give away a competitive advantage such as the Congress. But there's also a great deal of risk involved, and we're fortunate as an institution that we've had the financial stability in order to sustain this program. It does carry higher risk, and one of the conditions of the approval of this program was that our fund balance level for the institution actually go up significantly higher than what is required of all the other institutions. And such a requirement might prove to be an impediment for the other institutions to consider that, given the ongoing impact of the afterthought budget process that we're in for higher education.
Thank you very much, Ms. McDonald. Thank you both for coming. With that, colleagues, we will... I don't sense that we need any amendments to this bill, and so we can get the process going on it. With that, I'm going to close this public hearing on House Bill 3472 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2838. Colleagues, 2838 is the Pay It Forward bill, and you'll remember we had a hearing on this a while ago. And, you know, this too, just as the previous bill, part of our affordability agenda, you know, for this committee, looking at ways to make access to higher ed more affordable to Oregonians. We had a hearing last time. We ran out of time. In that hearing, there were a number of people who still wanted to testify and that I think it's important for us to hear from. So we've scheduled this public hearing in order to accomplish that. Also, at your dais, I've worked with the advocates to prepare a set of amendments. I'll just point out to you the main thing that the amendments do is provide a list of whereases for your benefit, just to give you and the public a better sense of what the problem is here and why this solution to the problem is being is being proposed. And of course, it's all about student debt and the problem of student debt and Pay It Forward, again, being a program that would in effect have the state assume the upfront cost of tuition for students and then the student would repay that obligation over time based on a percentage of their monthly earnings. The bill also changes Oregon Education Investment Board to Higher Ed Coordinating Commission and Oregon Student Access Commission, which are more appropriate, really, for the kind of study that's being proposed here. And again, what is being proposed here is, a study preparing a potential pilot project for Pay It Forward here in Oregon. And it also calls for a deletion in something somewhere. I'm sorry.
Very bottom of page 2.
Yeah, it's at the bottom of page 2, delete line 24. And that I think had there was a section in here that said that any schools that participated in a pilot project had to be the pilot project had to be equal in both schools, and that seemed against the notion of a pilot project, which might suggest that you try different things at different schools, and so we removed that that element. So that, in a nutshell, is the revised bill, and let's hear from some people. I'll call up Sammy Alloy, Barbara Dudley, and Joel Fisher, please.
Excuse me.
Okay, Sammy, did you want to start?
Sure. Good morning, Chair Dembro, Vice Chairs Huffman and Harker, members of the committee. Thank you for having me. For the record, my name is Sammy Alloy. I'm here on behalf of Oregon Working Families. But perhaps more importantly, I'm also here as a recent graduate of Portland State University and as someone who cares deeply about affordability and access to our state's quality public higher education system. I received my BA from PSU in 2011, and despite having access to a scholarship, the Pell Grant, and the Oregon Opportunity Grant, I graduated with $18,000 in student debt. That's well below our current statewide average, which is now more than $25,000 per student. But I can assure you it feels like plenty to me. My debt is a psychological and financial burden. It prevents me from saving more for my retirement, making investments, visiting my parents, and a host of other financial decisions. But I still think that getting an education was one of the best decisions that I've ever made, and that's why it's really important for me to ensure that future students have access to a higher education if they want one. Oregon Working Families was a community partner for the PSU Capstone class on student debt policy and advocacy that helped create this bill. Through the Capstone, I've been working with really brilliant and dedicated students from the PSU community who you had an opportunity to hear from at the first public hearing for this bill. So without rehashing their testimony, I'll just reiterate that this is something that students are very deeply invested in. I've also emailed Victoria a petition that's been signed by over 4,000 Oregonians across the state in support of this bill. This is something that people across the state really care about. Student debt is no longer an issue that only affects the young. According to a recent report by the National Association of Consumer Bankruptcy Attorneys, student loans to parents for their children's education have actually increased by 75% since 2005. Nationally, that average debt per family is $34,000, which over a standard 10-year repayment plan becomes $50,000. That's an inaccessible price to pay for Oregon working-class and middle-class families. And just on a personal note, I know that about 40 to 50% of my monthly student loan payment actually goes to interest and doesn't even go towards the principal or help create a stable funding stream for our cash-strapped universities. Pay It Forward makes it possible for students to graduate without debt. Unlike the federal income-based repayment program, students would not graduate with debt on their credit report as they enter an uncertain job market. Having a high debt-to-income ratio that students like myself have hampers graduates' access to equity, which makes young people more likely to delay investment decisions like buying a home or starting a small business. It makes them less able to spend in our local economy, and frankly, it makes people afraid to take investment risks that are critical to innovation and job creation. While Pay It Forward is not a catch-all solution for all of the problems that are facing our public higher education system, it would be a critical step towards making public higher ed more accessible and affordable for students. And together with continued public investment from the legislature, Pay It Forward would create a stable and growing funding stream for our universities over the long term. This idea is very new, and I know we all have a lot of questions about how it would work. But our public higher education system clearly needs bold and innovative solutions if we are to meet our 40-40-20 goals. This idea, as well as others such as the Treasurer's Oregon Opportunity Initiative Plan, deserve more exploration, and I urge the committee to support a task force that would do that research. I know that the Oregon Community College Association also has concerns that community college might be be able to opt in to participating in a pilot program rather than being mandated by the state to do so, and we have no problem with that. I know that there are numerous ways that a task force could implement a pilot program, and I want to leave it up to those experts to do so. So thank you very much for hearing my remarks, and I will answer any questions.
Thank you, Sammy. Barbara?
Thank you, Chair Denbrough. My name is Barbara Dudley. I was one of...
And Barbara, these mics are really sensitive, so you don't... You can just sit back as if you're in a normal...
classroom?
Yeah.
I was one of the professors in the capstone at Portland State that developed this proposal, and I'm not here with any prepared testimony. I just wanted to add one piece, which is to say that the students in that capstone reviewed a lot of possibilities. They were looking at the problem of student debt, which wasn't new to any of them, and trying to find solutions. And many of those solutions rest at the federal level. And given the current dysfunction on the federal level, they turned their attention to the state, also because we are here in Oregon, and they are Oregon students going to Oregon Public University. So in that process, they came across this proposal of Pay It Forward that was developed by the Economic Opportunity Institute in Washington State. I think it's important that we look further into the possibilities of this program. That's all they're asking, is that we study it and we think about it. Because for students to think about the possibility, it's like one step beyond the Western promise. It's saying you can go to school and pay afterwards, and you pay into a fund that then supports future students. So it's a renewing fund. Yes, the state has to come up with the ways to do the upfront funding, but there are also foundations out there that are talking about contributing to this as a program-related investment or a mission-related investment. So there are many possible ways in which I think there are a lot of businesses, too, that could be induced to support this, who support higher education in this state. So that's all I wanted to say. If you have any questions about the development of this proposal, I am here.
Thank you.
Chair Denbrough, members of the committee, my name is Joel Fisher, Senior Policy Analyst with the Oregon Business Association. Thanks, Barbara, for the invitation to come and speak to this bill. Improving access to post-secondary education is a key pillar of OBA strategic plan, and we support moving Oregon towards the goal of 40-40-20 through pursuit of a fundamental redesign of Oregon's education system and funding models. Oregon's college students are paying more, borrowing more, working longer hours for their educations. While OBA has not had time to formally review this proposal, we commend the authors for seeking creative solutions to push our educational goals of increasing access to a post-secondary education for all Oregonians in line with our goal of 40-40-20. It's great to see people out there trying to find these creative solutions. I'm still paying off college debt. And as young as this committee is, I can't help but wonder if we had proposals like this, if the average age of the legislature might come down just a little bit. Thank you.
Okay, so much for your testimony, Mr. Fisher. Yes, Rep. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sammy, quick question for you. In your testimony, you referred multiple times to eliminating debt. My way of reading this, we're not eliminating debt. We're just trying to design a different way for students to pay that back. Is that correct?
Chair Denbrough, Rep. Johnson, I think that there's a critical difference in my mind in that students would graduate without a debt on their credit report. So rather than servicing a debt, chipping away at a price tag that they owe, they're actually paying a percentage of their income into a growing fund that would go to fund the future. I think that's a critical difference, not only in logistically how it works for graduates and their credit, but also in how we frame funding for higher education. Additionally, I know that it may not eliminate student debt for students completely because there are, you know, textbooks, housing, there are additional costs, but it makes it much more attainable to work through college and together with other aid programs that exist and savings, it might be possible for a student to graduate without any debt.
Just to follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Rick Johnson.
I appreciate that, but with this proposal, I think it's actually possible that it may take a student longer to actually retire that debt, depending on the terms of repayment, mm-hmm. i.e., if someone has a much, much smaller percentage of his or her mm-hmm. income on a monthly basis, annual basis, however it's determined, it's possible that the debt could actually be there for a longer period of time. It's just going to take a smaller percentage of his or her income on an annual basis. So I just think it's important to get that on the record. We're not eliminating debt. We're just right. modifying the terms of repayment to make it more affordable for the graduates, and I think that's important to get out
there. Sure. Rep. Jembro, Rep. Johnson, I think you're right that it is a more affordable payment for a longer period of time, but part of the reason why the students looked at that option and that repayment period is that over that long term, median income per year after graduation increases, and so if we're to make it a sustainable long-term growing fund, capturing some of that higher earning potential of adults after they leave college is part of the sustainability of the fund. But there are experts here, including John Burbank and Jason Gettle from the Oregon Center for Public Policy, who helped create those numbers. So I would say if you have any questions about the specifics, I would leave it up to them to answer those.
Right. I just have one question.
Yes.
In terms of the age issue, I just want to ask you one question. Are you now or have you ever been 25 years old?
I had to ask. I'm sorry.
I have been. I'm not now.
Oh, okay. All right. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, colleagues. Thank you, all three of you.
And more younger people.
I'm going to call up
some money for the
President Benvivo and Bridget Burns, and colleagues. Again, we do have John Burbank and Jason in the audience. If you have any technical questions about the program, you'll remember how helpful they were last time. President Benvivo, welcome back.
Yes, it's a pleasure to be here again. I'll be missing you all. for the record, my name is Vin Viva. I'm president of Portland State University, and I'm pleased to be here to testify in support of House Bill 2838. Of course, first of all, it's important because I'm very proud of the work that the PSU faculty members, Mary King and Barbara Dudley, and the group of study students have done in the context of a capstone project on this bill. But more importantly, of course, I think that this idea and variants of it could have a profound effect on how Oregon students pay for their college education. I won't rehearse in detail the arguments about student debt. You have seen the data about how much student debt has grown. The average now nationally is about $24,000. But there are a smaller percentage of students who have really very large debts. 18% has between $25,000 and $50,000, and nearly 4% have balances of over $100,000. And this has indeed been a very rapid rise over the last 10 years or so, where student debt has tripled. And a recent federal report confirmed very much that there are many causes of this. The key cause is related, unfortunately, to the state cuts to public colleges and universities. Not the only cause. Some of the practices of private, for-profit institutions certainly have played a role as well, but the state cuts have been a very big part. As you heard me say before, at Portland State, even though the cost of education after adjusting for inflation has basically stayed flat for 15 years, the total cost of what we spent on a student, the price that students have to pay has gone up a lot because of the cutback in state aid. As a result, the average student debt at Portland State now is $26,000, just a little bit above the national average, for the 64% of those who graduate with debt. At times, people do forget that there are students who do graduate without debt as well, people who pay themselves, their parents pay themselves. But it's also important to know, though, that student debt is just one of the affordability and access issues that we face. The need for increased state appropriations is clearly very important, so we can control the increases in state tuition. The need for us to continue to be very vigilant about controlling costs wherever we can. Looking for ways to increase scholarship aid because there are other costs, as was mentioned earlier, related to textbooks and housing and so on. At the federal level, there is a lot of interesting stuff going on. There is some, what you might say, a version of pay it forward, where students can opt to pay back their loan as a percentage of their income. It's a specific debt for the student with specific amounts, so it's not the same as what is being discussed here. Right now, that program is not advertised well. Students don't know about it. They're still paying interest on it. But the Gates Foundation just funded 16 organizations, it's nice to be rich, to develop new models of student financing. And those will be discussed in Congress over the next year, although I agree with the earlier comments that if we have to wait for Washington to solve our problems, it could be a very long wait. Therefore, I think we need to do our share at the state level, and pay it forward and other ideas can help make our colleges and universities more affordable and accessible, and then we should study that. But we must also be clear that this idea alone, even if it were to reduce or eliminate student loan debt, cannot solve Oregon's affordability and accessibility challenges. It will not slow the rising cost of tuition or increase the capacity of aging classrooms suffering from decades of deferred maintenance. And it will not address the cost of textbooks or student housing, help us pay faculty to teach courses, or cover the increased cost of employee benefits, obviously a very big issue for us. So I think it's critical that we address these other financial considerations as well as the issue of student debt if we want to succeed. So I think that this is a great time to convene a legislative funding and affordability task force with representation from the public, community colleges, universities, legislators, unions, faculty, and students to do a comprehensive study of the many student aid ideas being proposed that could also look, so I think the charge of the task force should be expanded to include a deep analysis of all the financial issues affecting the affordability of our universities. So in conclusion, let me reiterate, we know that student success is highly correlated with affordability, especially at a university with an access mission, like really all or most of our public institutions are. And I believe that programs like Pay It Forward with further study may provide our students with some of the debt relief that they need to attend a university. And I hope that you will consider expanding the charge so we can look at the full set of issues. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. President. Ms. Burns.
Chair Denbrough, members of the committee, for the record, Bridget Burns, Chief of Staff for the Oregon University System. I'm just here to offer some comments and briefly in support of this legislation. As President Vivelle mentioned, we are incredibly proud of our students who come up with great ideas to help solve a lot of Oregon's problems, and this is one example of that. Our request would be to expand this particular investigation because we think there are a lot of innovative ideas out there, and implementation, there are just a lot of questions about them. For instance, we could look at how Australia implements a similar program, how the fixed UC proposal was versus this proposal, and also what is done in the United Kingdom. And we think also the ideas that were brought forward in the new partnership from the University of Oregon, the idea of bonding for operations. There are a multitude of different structures and ideas that we should investigate in terms of how can we fund and support higher education differently, because the current model is simply not sustainable based on a lot of the reasons that you heard from President Vivelle. So at OUS, it's our job to innovate. We think innovation is a great idea. We think this idea is innovative. We would just hope that we not limit ourselves in our exploration of different topics, and the topics we would say should include not just different ways to do financial aid, but we think just in general how we fund higher education and how we ought to think differently about our approach to supporting publicly financed institutions. This particular idea, the questions that came to mind, we have some research done on the subject. I've sent that to you, Representative Denbrough. I'm happy to share that more extensively. We have a research assistant here from OUS in the audience, Brian Fox, who can answer specific questions about this. The questions that we had were mainly about how to operationalize it in terms of do we need the IRS to be involved in terms of with setting it up? And also, does it potentially disincentivize high-income earning majors from participating in the program? If you know you're going to be in a field that's going to make a lot of money, it would be in your best interest to opt out, and therefore that creates some instability. So I think just looking at the differences of how they've implemented it in Australia and the United Kingdom and different ideas that are out there, we should just really expand it in terms of our inquiry. But we are proud of our students. We think these are great ideas, and we're happy to engage with the legislature in conversations like this.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Bridget. You know, and I do think that those questions and those research metrics are exactly what will be explored in the, you know, by the heck if we pass this bill and set them onto this task. I believe that is the intent of this. You know, we heard a bill earlier that Rep. Wisnan brought us having to do with the Western Oregon Promise. My hunch is we're going to be sending that one down to Ways and Means as well. I'm hoping that before 10, we will also be voting on another bill having to do with the Next Generation Fund. That too go down to Ways and Means as we, you know, try to really explore, as you say, a whole variety of funding alternatives that can make college affordable. Rick Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Hitting on something that Bridget just said, might I propose that rather than this committee sending multiple bills to Ways and Means talking about similar topics, i.e. tuition affordability, student debt, and so forth and so on, that we try to consolidate these into one instrument that could be one bill that could call for the heck to work on this proposal, to work on the previous bill we just heard and so forth, and amend these together into one instrument rather than have multiple bills, rather than four of them sitting down there. Let's just have one saying, this committee is serious about this. These are the components we think we'd love to have the heck research in the interim, come back in February with some specific proposals or the following legislative session. But to consolidate all this work into rather than multiples, I think it might be more effective in terms of focusing the attention of this committee on the problems that we have had represented in front of us that really need some addressing and so forth. But just a thought, Mr. Chair, but I think you might find other support for that at the committee level as well.
Thank you. Did anybody have specific questions of these two? And then I'd be happy to have us have that conversation. Okay. Thank you both very much.
Thank you very much.
Let me also ask, does anybody have any technical questions, since John, Jason are here, about the pay it forward?
I just have one.
Okay, John, would you come up, and Jason as well? Thank you. Okay, Rep. Gorsuch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that Rep. Johnson's earlier question was really interesting in terms of this issue of drawing things out for long periods of time. But then I was wondering, and I don't remember from reading this, is there still an interest component in this bill, or do we lose that by going to this system?
Well, thank you very much, Representative Dembrough and Representative Gorsuch. And the answer to that question is that this is not a debt instrument. So this is an instrument where you go to college and do not pay tuition, period. And the quid pro quo is that you are contributing for a predetermined number of years, right, at a predetermined rate of your income. And so that's your responsibility.
So I believe it was your example of if you do 34,000, then the interest bumps it to 50,000. So that wouldn't be operational in this piece. You would just be doing the 34,000.
Yes, you would. You wouldn't be doing the 34,000.
Well, I mean, in terms of what you pay back.
Excuse me, John. Could I just interrupt? I neglected to ask you to identify yourself record.
Okay. So my name is John Burbank. I'm the executive director of the Economic Opportunity Institute in Seattle, Washington.
and we developed the initial proposal for this. So I think perhaps there's a little bit of a paradigm shift in looking at this, and that's why we call it pay it forward. So for example, let me just give you an idea of how this would work. If we were to come up with, say, 2% of the endowment at Oregon State University and invest it in this, that would enable about 1,400 students to participate and pay it forward. If you kept that steady investment over time, as these students then contributed upon graduation to pay it forward, you would essentially, within 20 years, you would be able to double the number of students who are on pay it forward. And so this is a way of figuring out a funding stream for the future while at the same time eliminating of the cost of tuition for current students. And that future funding stream then allows that next generational cohort of students this same access, and then they're wound into the pay it forward program. So it is a different way of thinking about this, but it is not debt. And in terms of for the median income student, graduate with say $30,000 of debt, you're going to end up paying, contributing less over that 25 years than you would if you're on a traditional student loan program. And of course, because it's extended over 25 years, you're not, you don't have this ball and chain of the first 5 years where you have this tremendous student debt when you're also establishing other things.
Follow up quickly, yes.
So just, I'm a little slow today. Just to make it clear then, if we were talking about total funds, there would be no interest payments as part of that.
That is correct.
Okay.
That is the key, because that means that all the contributions go into this trust fund that would then fund the tuition or the placeholder for tuition for the next group of students coming along. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes. And colleagues, so let me remind you that one of the challenges, of course, to a program like Pay It Forward is coming up with those startup costs, you know, to be able to, to do the upfront. And, one of the possible sources for those startup funds that we've talked about is the bonding that the treasurer is seeking for the his Oregon Opportunity Initiative. And that bill is down in Ways and Means now. It moved on the Senate side, as well as potentially using proceeds from those bonds for the Oregon Opportunity Initiative. The treasurer has indicated that a program like Pay It Forward would be a very complementary kind of use of that bonding capacity as well. That proposal would require a vote of the people, because it would be a constitutional change to allow us to bond for human infrastructure. Would probably come before the voters in November of 2014. In the meantime, we will be exploring Pay It Forward as an option, the Opportunity Initiative as an option, and perhaps come up with a combination of the two. So, any other questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you
both very much, gentlemen. Okay, colleagues, to the question of whether you would like these sent down as separate bills or as one combined bill, I'm happy with either. You know, I think if we're essentially just merging these two, I think that could be useful. Mm-hmm. Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Victoria, I don't know if you're the person to ask. There's going to be a financial impact, either to some sort of impact. Would it be better to put them together? Is that going to save us as far as?
These, Representative Chair Dembrough, these are both task force bills, yes?
task forces kind of have a standard
minimum,
yeah. But they all do go to Ways and Means so that Ways and Means can decide how many task forces we are indeed funding.
Yeah, I saw that.
I would think that the fewer task forces you submit, the more likely it is for the ones you submit to.
Right. Just follow up. Thank you for that information, mm-hmm. Mr. Chair. But I think the pay it forward, pay back later, whatever. But that one was going to a different thing. We said with the bill that we talked about, that we introduced, was going to the HEC.
With the amendment, this will also go to the HEC.
Okay, good. I support that, sir. Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's what we'll do then. I'm going to close the public hearing then on House Bill 2838, and we will schedule a work session on that bill once we have done the amendments to bring these two bills together.
Okay.
Colleagues, we have scheduled a work session for House Bill 3025, but I think I'm going to carry that forward so that we can move on to the next part of our day's agendas. I'm carrying over the public hearing the work session on House Bill 3025, and colleagues, we are adjourned.